Welcome everyone to the July 23rd, 2019 0100 Zulu session of Tangerine SDR on TeamSpeak. I'm Dan, N4XWE, and I'll get things started, then we'll go down the list and then back to the top of the list. Okay, so this week I kind of came across a pet peeve, which is a little bit, I think, a little bit more than germane to what we're doing here, and it has to do with documentation. I compiled WSJTX from source. I've done it a number of times before. It's incredibly good software done by an incredibly talented group of people. And the documentation that they've generated for it was at one time very, very good, but they failed to keep up with the changes that have happened to the software and especially to compiling the software. And then I did it in Linux and it has a bunch of dependencies and it's a big issue. So anyway, that's kind of my blurb. I hope that we keep that in mind as we go further along in this project. It's really important to keep the software documentation up to date for the benefit of everyone. Okay, so that off my chest. Mike AA8 is listed as with his mic unmuted. Nathaniel W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel. Whoops, I guess Nathaniel was not with us. With us, but not. Next on the list is Rick, WGPS. Go ahead, Rick.
Oh, good evening. I don't have a whole lot to say today. I'd touch base with John Ackerman regarding some testing of various possible implementations of a steered oscillator module. But we haven't actually come up with a plan on specifically what test and why, but we're getting there. I also had investigated purchasing a piece of test equipment to assist in that process, but when I was quoted $13,600 for that piece of equipment, I decided to just let John do the testing. That's pretty much all I have right now.
Okay, thanks, Rick. Moving right on down the list to Tom, N5 Echo Golf. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dan, and everyone on the list. Let's see, first thing, released a first draft the RF module specification. There's two variants, dual channel and a single. This is something we may want to discuss later in the session, how we identify and those that we use for the personal space weather station, those that are useful, probably not support PSW. Secondly, I updated the magnetometer spec and changed the interface magnetometer chip from SPUC. Dave Witten's excellent discussion last week, the chipset, extender chipset. And it looks like the extender can go out to about 100 feet if you slow the 100 kilobits per. And that is the old original I2C. So the spec. And thirdly, updated the clock module specification and added a variance table to that. And at the end of the spec that lists one is a stability we may want to use for the PSWS, and then other stability options, which folks may be useful in their own right, not as part of the space, just because it's a cool module, it's got a synth, and folks may, and so tried to list out those in the spec.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tom. Moving to the top of the list, Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, as Phil would say, for those around the world who are probably listening later. And thanks, Dan, for taking up the gauntlet here. I hope that Dave is okay. He missed this week. He's hasn't had a relapse there. But anyway, and again, thanks to Mike for recording and posting. And Tom, I got on my list here to review the document you posted. You're being quite prolific. It's great to see all the new stuff coming out. And I think I have some comments to get to you. And I have been working a little bit on the requirements document for the overall for the Tangerine SDR. And I'm not so much focusing on the space weather station, but focusing on what the Tangerine will do. And then kind of getting down to the later sections, which will outline the use cases, which will be, which is space weather. And I think that's about all I have this week. Getting busy at work and getting a lot of things done, which is good because I'm trying to clear the deck off for putting in more time on this project. So back over to you, Dan.
Okay, thanks, Scotty. Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, good evening, everyone. A couple things. I am working still on developing a more realistic simulation of what our Tangerine data engine may actually put out and testing it with the Odroid N2. I found out that a lot of my previous work was using a certain there is a sort of a default setting, which is it's the most minimal compression. But what it does is it leaves out all those items you did not save. In other words, if it calculates how many things should have been saved, how many data elements should have been saved, and if you don't save it, it just leaves them out. And that is a minimal level of compression. Well, I found out I really want to show up as either zeros or not a number, so I know that I'm missing something. So I've been redoing a lot of my simulations. I spent this afternoon working on that, and I'm getting much better with it. I had a lot of help from the Haystack Digital RF team on that. So I also had a lengthy discussion with Nathaniel this afternoon about a discussion he had with the National Science Foundation, and I want him to tell the group about it, because he was in that discussion and I wasn't, so I don't want to steal his thunder. But anyway, he does have some stuff to tell the group about it. Hopefully he will be able to get back onto the call in a minute. He might have had to step away from the phone.
Okay, thank you, Bill. Okay, Dave Witten is here. So KD0EAG, go ahead, Dave.
Hi, I just popped in. I had some other things that were holding me up. Just here to listen tonight. Nothing important to report.
Okay, thanks, Dave. And we'll go back to Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Thank you very much, Dan. I really appreciate it. I was here the whole time. I just had some Technifique software, so sorry about that. But yes, as Bill mentioned, I have some really exciting news. A couple months ago, we submitted a grant to the National Science Foundation to what they call the DAISY, the Distributed Array of. And in that proposal, we included some support to help buy some development time from Scotty and help move the Tangerine SDR project along to support some of my academic work, and also to support Case Western in the development of the Doppler receiver, and also to support Bill and the University of Alabama in developing the software backend. And I'm very pleased to say that our proposal was selected. This is a highly competitive grant, and we were selected. So this is really, really good. They did ask us to reduce our funding level a little bit. So Scotty, Case Western, University of Alabama, and I, we all have to redo our budgets a bit, but we have funding for the next 3 years to help support this project. So this is really good for the project and for HAMSCI and Tapper too, I think. So this is very exciting.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thanks, Nathaniel. I guess that takes care of everyone who's on the list and has their microphone on. So we'll open the floor up to general discussion.
Yeah, congratulations, Nathaniel. That was mostly due to your effort in getting all that data gathered together and writing it up and getting it reviewed and submitting it to NSF and in a format that beat out all the other competition.
Thank you very much, Scotty.
Yeah, I have set up a meeting with the major professor from the CS department who is going to head up the technical development on the software side. I'm going to meet with him tomorrow, and we'll work on an update to the budget.
Thanks, Bill. That's really good. Yeah, I'm very happy. I really think it'll help move us along, and I'm very excited that it's going to. I just think this is really good, because one of the things that I've been doing as I've been working on HAMSCI academically, I get a lot of response from people in the NSF and people saying, "Oh, this ham radio and sciencing, it's a good idea," but it's hard to get legitimacy, and things like this really helps to provide some legitimacy in the eyes of the National Science Foundation and the academic world for the work that we're doing.
And I think you targeted the exact things that they're interested in. And I mean, maybe it's, I don't want to take credit away from you, because you did a great job on the proposal. But, you know, when you read the request for proposals, it had our project name written all over it.
Oh, I know. That's why we had to submit to this. I was going through a time period where I was like, I don't know, this is a lot of work. I'm not sure if I want to go through and do this. But yeah, it just matched so well. I felt like we had to do it. And I'm really glad we did.
So I guess now that means we have to actually make it work, right?
I know, it does. It's like, yes, we got the grant. But yes, now we actually have to really pull something together that the National Science Foundation is going to like.
You would have to bring that up.
Yeah. Well, I figure, you know, we all seem to be having fun building these things anyway and trying to do something good. So I think it'll work out just fine.
Well, you remember that commercial on TV years and years ago that when the internet startups were new and there was a bunch of guys sitting around when their web page went live and they had an order counter. And the web page went live and the order counter started going like tick, 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 and then it started going up, and it ended up going up by like tens of thousands, and they went from excitement to worry about how they're going to fill the orders.
I know, it's a little bit like that, but I really think we can do it.
No, we got a really good jump start with all the documents that Bill and Tom have put out and on the discussions we've had to kind of help steer those. So I think it's, we're well on the way.
I agree. I'm impressed with what everyone's done so far, and I'm really grateful too. I just think it's coming along quite nicely. And I'm obviously going to continue being here working on it and helping and doing whatever I can to help make this happen. So I'm quite excited.
So Tom, did you have... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, Nathaniel, is Grant going to be available to be read by those on the team in some?
Sure, I'd be happy to pass it around.
Okay, I'm sure there'd be folks who'd like to see it.
Yeah, let me finish. Let's get these revised budgets done, and then I'll send the project description around. So probably sometime next week.
Oh, sure. There's no hurry at all.
Probably a good idea to make sure it's actually awarded before we publicize anything, because something like that could...
Yeah, that's true. I should... I got an email directly from the program officer yet, but it hasn't officially been awarded through the system yet. So I guess as Yogi Berra says, it ain't over till it's over. So we do need to actually get it through the whole system and make sure the NSF accepts the revised budgets and what we plan on doing. So I guess Bill's right. Don't make big announcements about this just yet, but I did want the team to know about it.
So like it ain't started till it's started?
Something like that. I think it started, but yeah.
Well, go
ahead.
That's
about right.
Yeah, we'll go ahead and hold on it and wait till it's all finalized and wrapped up with a nice bow.
Okay, that sounds really good.
Yeah, like Yogi Berra said, you know, I never really wrote all that buggy code that I...
That's right. He did say that, didn't he?
Or nobody goes there, it's too crowded.
That's right.
Right.
And my favorite story is so right now I live just a couple miles from where he lived. And they always tell that story about, you know, what he said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. And he was actually giving directions to his friend's house, to his house, to a friend. And there actually is a fork in the road that if you go to the left or to the right, you get up to his house. And there's a stone, a big rock memorializing that fork. So I get to go over and see Yogi Berra's fork every once in a while.
That's great.
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
So did you have some things to say about documentation, Tom?
Yeah. What, one of the comments that came up, I talked a little bit to John Ackerman during the week, and, we have Tangerine, which is, I think, more than just the personal space weather station. And so there's a lot of the modules folks are going to play with outside of it. And I was trying to come up with a way so that the project would know which modules, you know, are the ones we're going to use on the project, and the other modules covered by the specs will know that we don't use in them. And so I made a stab at that. I think it was the RF module, it was in the clock module spec, the approach to do. So I was just wondering, maybe it works.
Well, let me send you what I have. I actually sat down a month ago and made up a Excel spreadsheet of part numbers. Actual part numbers. And I was thinking about that too in our documents. Do we want to assign document numbers to these, or are we getting way too carried away here?
Oh gosh, I don't care. I just put a variant table. I figured a variant table in every spec would be enough. But, you know, we have four modules and there's two specs. We've got eight documents and then we have probably another six or so. It's getting enough. The numbers might.
Okay, well, let me go back to my table of documents that I put together, a table of names. And because what I did is I basically said, okay, we're going to have a bunch of RF modules. We're going to have a bunch of clock modules. Well, I mean, a bunch, maybe more than two, okay, of each. So we got to find a way to differentiate these. So either some kind of descriptive name or part number or both but I'm not sure that I would want to say that the GPSDO should be called the PSWS GPSDO, because I think that John and you probably agree with this, is that that module could be put on a baseboard and sold to the time nuts, and it would, which would have nothing to do with Space Weather Station, but yet they'd still like to play with it.
Yeah, that was the whole point of the variance table. There would be a version that the PSWS probably have a certain stability, but other people might want to use that model and might want to play with it. And, you know, maybe they want a higher performance oscillator, or, you know, or there may be some differences. And so I felt we needed a table to identify, you know, which, even though there might be three or four different flavors.
Right. And I would call all of the flavors Tangerine Clock Module X, Tangerine Clock Module Y. So all of the clock modules, all the RF modules, all the, and there may be more than one data engine by the time we're done here. All these are all Tangerine parts. But when you build a personal space weather station, you're going to take Tangerine data engine type 1 and hook it to RF module type 2 and hook it, use a clock module type 1, and that will become the system description for the PSWS.
Yeah, I understand that. One of the issues, for example, in the ELs is that, you know, somebody may want a low cost. They might leave off the noise source and the noise relay, you know, maybe some other parts. And that would get the cost way down, and there's probably a bunch of folks who would like to use that, but it wouldn't meet the requirements of the project. And so the question, so I tried to in those kind of situations, but maybe that's not the best way to.
Well, it's, in my experience, the way we do that is, say you have a GPSDO clock module, but then, for instance, that's a bad example. Say the RF module. So you have a dual channel HF clock or RF module. And it has on the in the artwork, it has the noise source and the switching for it. And then we decide, well, we can make it cheaper by leaving those parts off the board. Well, that may use the same PC board, but that becomes a different variant. And Rick, I have a request for you. If you could switch to ETT instead of box, because we're getting feedback from that. Anyway, so Tom, so the variance would be, they might use the exact same PC board, but if it's a lower cost variant, then it would have a different. So we'd have to figure out how to identify those ones that would be similar but not the same, because they're depopulated versions. And so maybe they'll have the same base description and they a restriction, or maybe I'm not sure exactly how we. I'm thinking part numbers are an easier way to do it, but then that becomes a little less friendly.
Yeah, I understand that. I just tried to lay out a table which, you know, merged in the module. But, you know, and that works with one or two modules, if you 4 or 5. So we'll need to come up with some. So the project goes, use this one particular, and there's some description in the specific noise source, and it's got those kind of things. So the Space Weather Station features it has.
Yeah, and then on the requirements document, the features are going to be different for each variant, each flavor. But on the ICD, the interface and the sizes and all that are going to come out of a standard table, right?
Well, yeah, that's if they're the same size and the same model, and it's just a populated, we might be able to do that. In the RF module specification, the receiver and the single receiver are almost identical. So rather than writing two different documents, I just put in the same in the table that says, you know, put one receiver, two receiver.
Okay, and I guess that would depend upon what you did, because if you use the two-channel ADC, it might not be so easy to whittle it down to one channel. But if you use two single-channel ones, you could just depopulate down to one.
Yeah, I tried not to describe which way that was, other than the spec just says Space Weather Station. And so that's why I think we needed to have this discussion. We need to come up with a way to identify which features are on module, which vary in the Space Weather Station. So we may have to scratch our heads a little bit. Maybe part numbers is a good one.
Okay, well, let me send you my part number table as a starting point and see what you think, and then hash it out via email. Maybe come up with some kind of plan by next week.
Okay, that sounds like we can put something out and the other folks can come.
Yeah, and I was planning to put the physical documents, those physical figures that I sent out, I was planning to put those in the the requirements document for the overall project, which is actually probably a ninth document, which is a like a Tangerine system document that says, okay, these are what modules that exist, and go see these documents to see how they plug together. And here's the general idea of how they fit together, but it's not going to be a specific it's so many millimeters wide and the connector is at coordinates XY, because I want to kind of get the feel for the system out before we actually have designed boards. Because I'm sure what's going to happen is, as soon as we start designing the physical boards, we're going to run into some issues and we're going to have to twiddle things around a little bit to make sure everything fits.
Yeah, that was my sense. Mechanical drawing and looking at parts needed to build the receiver, it just appeared to me that there's not quite enough square.
Yeah, and if you think that we're really going to end up building like many 40 millimeter by 65 or 85 or 100 millimeter, extend them out, we can't really make them any wider if they're going to be a pie shield, a pie type thing. But we could then extend the data engine underneath them to be wider. It's just that I really wanted to try to keep the thing as small as possible so that we could stack the boards up instead of having a big giant thing like the Atlas system, a big case. I want something that's relatively compact if it's possible.
Yeah, I understand that. Of course, you know, the needs of the modules are going to dictate how big they are. The dual channel receiver view's got, and so they can only be made so small. If they extend out, we need to take care that we have additional mounting and supports. If a long module is hanging a connector, we're going to need some support attach it.
Yeah, and you must have a support post for anything that uses an M.2 connector, because the connector itself doesn't actually retain anything. It relies on you tilting the board down to get contact. And I'm thinking we put that post at as close to the edge of the data engine as possible, so that it'll end up being in the middle of the RF board, which is probably not that convenient because it's going to disrupt the circuit flow. But for a two-channel board, you know, if we assign the pins right, you can flow the data on either side of that post. And so that we may be able to make that work. And I think, you know, if right now a 40 by 40 board fits over the top of the data engine, so even if you made it 40 by 80, so you've got basically the post in dead center in the board, I don't know if that will be mechanically sufficient or not, but it might be.
Yeah, my worry there is that you're going to have two SMAs on the end of the RF module that's out in space. I don't know how robust that.
Yeah, so I think what we're talking about is a base plate that goes under the DE that has tall standoffs for the RF board and shorter standoffs for the DE, and in place of the Raspberry Pi, or maybe sandwiched between it and the Raspberry Pi or the Odroid. So, but like I said, I think a lot of these mechanical things we're going to find out what we can do when we try to lay the boards out, because I don't know if I told you this, but we did the IQ2. Before we did the IQ2, we did the HF1 and HF2 modules. The HF2 module was actually first, and it's like 53 by 80 millimeters. And I intended to get that on a board half the size until I talked to the layout guy, and then he told me what reality was and that you're not getting all those parts on there. So the board grew to almost 50% bigger size. So if that happens, we had to be able to deal with it. You know, it's got to put the parts somewhere, right?
Yeah, that was the kind of my thing. Dual channel one is whenever we have SM edges of birds that are going to hook to RG for some wax, they put a lot of mechanical stress. And so I was figuring part of the module pretty close to the SMA connector is going to have to be fixed pretty solid.
Well, we could put UFL connectors on there and use pigtails and make it, just adds to the cost though.
And the reliability. The UFLs, I think, are good, but they're easy to pop a connector unintentionally. There's, you know, if there's not, you know, but you might be able to solve that by having an SMA, that SMA, and screw.
Do you want to say something, Dave?
Well, I had been just going to suggest the same thing, a UFL pigtail to a SMA that was, a bulkhead mounted and very stable, but it seems to be common practice to do that sort of thing.
Yeah, in fact, you know, you might even do SMA to bulkhead mounted. Although, of course, what's going to happen is somebody's going to not use the bulkhead mounted connector and hook RG58 right up to it, and then, you know, bad things could happen.
Yeah, that's just been my experience in the past, is an SMA, a lot of stress, at least account for it. So it'll be interesting to see after we get a bill of materials together. We've got 10 million parts and we got a couple hundred square.
Yeah, and I've got a layout person who is willing to work on this in his spare time and take a risk with us. And I worked with him for ages. So I think we'll probably try and use him to do the actual layout. And I'm sure I could scarf a few minutes of his time to take a look at, even if we just took a look at the major parts that are on the board and say, okay, let's assume that, you know, we have the typical number of bypass caps and like that. What do you think the minimum area you can squeeze it into is? And you know, other than the heat issue, we could put one channel on the top of the board, one channel on the bottom. If we made the pinout correct, you wouldn't need any vias at all for the to go to the connector if we laid the thing out properly. But I'm worried that if we put a part on the bottom, we might not get enough airflow to keep it cool, especially an ADC.
Yeah. The ADCs get a little bit. I don't know how bad they are. You've dealt with them before. Are they pretty warm?
Yeah, the 2208 consumes about 1.5 watts of power, and it's a little bitty 64 pin. It's just like a half an inch square, so it gets really hot. In fact, we like to glue heat sinks on the top of them. So the argument there would be to try to keep those in the overhang part, even if they're on the bottom, so that they would be open to air, so we could actually blow some air on them.
Okay. Well, yeah, there's a lot of consideration. Another thing, when I was looking at the updated magnetometer spec, it looks like we need 3.3 and 5 volts, 3.3 to run the IC. Is that connector capable of dual supplies, or is it?
Yeah, it's a single supply, either 5 or 3. So could we supply 5 and then regulate it down? Are we going to be supplying 5 volts in the cable itself then?
Yeah, I was thinking we would supply 5 volts as the DC power on the cable and then have a low dropout regulator on the remote side. We're down to 3. The line driver and receiver chips are 3-volt chips. I figured if we tried to run 3.3 volts down to cable, you know, we wouldn't be exactly sure the DC mode ends. So if we ran 5-volt at a regulator through, that would be fine. We could use that same low drop the local and just feed module on the module regular 0.3.
Okay, and how critical is the 5 volts on the chip itself? Because if you're going to be feeding 5 volts down the wire, you're going to have a pretty good filter on that. It's going to hook it right to a VCC of a chip.
The chips run on 3 volts. The reason for 5-volt was so that a regulator at the remote end, and even if you had a 0.5-volt drop along the cable, that low dropout regulator on the remote end would still.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood. I thought you needed both 3.3 and 5 at the far end. No, that's a perfect solution. And you get LDOs with only a few tenths of a volt overhead.
Yeah, so we could put an LDO on the local end to derive the 3.3 volts for the local end chipset, low dropout remote end. So the chipset, my view was 3 volts to drive.
Yeah, we're talking like maybe 50 milliamps max, right?
I didn't look at the power. It's not a lot, but I figured it was, if you have 100 feet of cable, you've got 200 feet round trip of tor gauge wire, and I figured we'd need a few hundreds of.
But if we use I2C, we only need one pair of wires, right? So that means we have basically 3 powers and 3 grounds we could parallel?
Yeah, the cable takes a diff pair of clock, a diff pair for data, and then we have 4 more wires left.
Okay, so 2 power and 2 ground, that will work perfect.
Yeah, so I think that'll be okay. And hopefully, you know, we can current limit the source of fire so that not if, but when somebody shorts the power source on the local, it just shuts in colorful smoke.
Yeah, PTCs are do a good job of that.
Yeah, so at any rate, so if the PMOD only supplies 1 voltage, then I'll go tweak the spec to just say it was both modes.
Okay, yeah, because I know on most PMOD interfaces, they have a jumper, and you can select either 5 or 3, and we can either fix it at 5, or we can do the same thing on the DE.
Okay, so the local module is going to need to have some, it could plug into the PMOD, you know, and then might need a stand, or your PMOD connector cable that the local magnetometer extender plug into. But in either case, the local magnetometer extend is going to have an Ethernet RJ45 on one end, so it's another case with mechanical mounting scheme extender.
Yeah, so I'm thinking either we'll put a plate underneath the whole thing, and then we'll need holes in all the boards, but then you're going to end up with an Ethernet extension cable out to a bulkhead mount, which you can do, but all these things add costs. So you might want to, and ribbon cables are much cheaper than Ethernet extension cables. So you might want to, we might want to consider mounting the local board. I mean, it's going to be very small. We might mount it right to the bulkhead and with the ribbon cable off of it over to the DE.
Yeah, that would work if we have a way that the local extender mechanically affixed pace and leave only the RJ45 for external use, then you could just use cheap.
Yeah, so if you use an RJ45 with ears on it that will mount to the chassis or some other kind of bracket, that would work.
Yeah, that RJ45 is going to need grounded and have a good grounding connection because I'm EMI on the magnetometer cable. And so we pocket a way to use a shield magnetometer interference.
Well, that sounds like a metal surrounded Ethernet jack that screws to the chassis. That would be a plus then.
Yeah, that could work real well, both provide shielding and mechanical integrity at the same
time. And I've seen Ethernet jacks, too, that have a round, like a ferrule on them, and then you just put a nut on them, and they're like a 7/8-inch hole or something, and they just mount to a single hole, and there's a nut on the outside. But typically, the ones that I've seen like that are waterproof kinds that have a rubber boot on the outside also.
Okay. Well, it's good to know that we have a couple of options there, that'll be good. So I'll go back and tweak the spec part, and that sounds like...
Yep, sounds good. So, Nathaniel, I don't know if you've been involved in the magnetometer discussion, but I don't know if Yoming has been involved in it or not, but I think we got the information from the guys at, was it University of Michigan? Or maybe Dave knows, because I think you bought one.
Yeah, I got the spec from the man directly.
So my question was, is this going to be good enough to use in the weather station to give us significant enough data?
I think so. So I have been following along. I saw that the revised documents came out, and I sent them over to Hyoman. And he said he was going to be on tonight, but I guess that didn't happen. So I will discuss that more with him. I'm also going to print out these documents and try to look at that.
Okay, very good, because I think we're progressing pretty well along the magnetometer front. So I'd hate to go down a road that was, I'd hate to take the fork when it was the wrong one.
Yeah, so let me follow up with Yeoman on that and try to review that magnetometer document.
Yeah, so it's not going to be any $1,300 magnetometer, but it might be useful.
Yeah, well, I think that's obviously the idea. We're not expecting, amazing performance, but we do want to have it be useful. And I think we'd like to do a field test of it at Jenny Jump Observatory, where we have a more expensive magnetometer, and we can put them side by side and see how it does.
Okay, well, this would be a good test of the whole system for a low data rate source then.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's one of the things we want to do with the grant is put all of this together, test some of these prototypes at Jenny Jump, compare it with some of the professional equipment we already have there, and see how it performs.
Yeah, because one of the things that, one of the changes that I made to the specification that I really haven't said much about was adding the an MEC connector. And you probably don't know what an MEC connector is. It's kind of not a common connector, but it's the connector that the HF1 and HF2 radio modules. And the object of that whole reasoning is if we come up with a data engine with a DE or with an MEC connector on it, then the existing HF1 and HF2 boards, which are already built and already available, will plug right onto it, in which case we have instant hardware. And that way we could focus on the other pieces of the system at the beginning, and we'd still have RF to play with. Our digitized RF.
That sounds good. So then the magnetometer could plug directly to the data engine, is what you're saying?
That's correct. And then the HF1 or HF2 modules would plug directly into the data engine also. And the HF1 is, unfortunately, both of the radios are single channel, HF1 and HF2. HF2 uses a 2208, so it is would be typical of one of the two channels that we use, maybe a little bit more robust. So, but it would at least be a source, a way to get a data engine with an RF, an antenna on it, and an RF, digitized RF stream, and a magnetometer all going relatively quickly.
Yeah, I think that sounds really good. So, just so I'm understanding, so right now the way we have the architecture set is we have all of our sensors are the radio, the RF boards, and the magnetometer. And the other things, they would all go to the data engine, and then the data engine would do a bunch of processing on that and then send it to the
Odroid, the single board computer. Is that right?
Right, right. And I forget what the name Bill has for that, the local processing. What was the name you gave to that, Bill?
Localhost. That's a carryover from the previous related project.
Okay, so then the data engine takes, it has two PMOD plugins, which are standard. So one of them can be used directly for the magnetometer. We'll have two RF modules, which at the beginning we will have none to plug into. It'll have an MEC connector, of which we will be able to plug an RF module into to get the source of RF. We'll have a clock module connector, which at the beginning we will have no clock module probably, but it'll have an onboard reasonable clock, but no GPSDO, so that when we get the RF modules and the GPSDOs, then we can just plug them in and rewrite the FPGA code to use the new data, and then we have the whole system.
That sounds good. Now, I do have, so one question I do have is, if we're doing a lower cost version of the personal space weather station, things like the magnetometer would not, like, if they could, the magnetometer should be able to plug to, say, like, the single board computer, and not to the data engine. Because if we have, say, like, the Case Western low cost just Doppler receiver, we're not going to have a data engine, right? But we still have to have a way of connecting both that and magnetometer and whatever other sensor we might have to the single board computer, right?
Right. We ought to be able to do that, because the inboard side of the magnetometer. Okay, so the magnetometer is the magnetometer unit with a remote conversion board that drives the cable, and then a local reconversion board that receives from the cable and converts back to I2C, which then goes to the data engine. But since we're using I2C on the data engine, the single board computer has I2C ports too. We can just wire to those.
Okay, so it could go directly to either. But the advantage of putting it into the data engine is the data engine has all the very accurate timestamps. Is that correct?
Right. So it can be included with the same format as the RF data that has timestamping on it. We can include the magnetometer data with that same format. And if you wanted to run it over, I mean, what I can see we could do, and Tom, maybe you maybe add this to the spec, is that we should have an I2C header that comes off the board that will be in a format that we can hook to the Odroid or the Raspberry Pi. So in case we mount the local board on a bulkhead, we have a ribbon cable over to the data engine, or we have a cable X, whatever it is, over to the Odroid, and we can hook it to either place then.
Yeah. Nathaniel, last week Phil mentioned that he thought using HDF5 or digital RF could also be used to encapsulate and metadata annotate the magnetometer sample, so that if we plugged it into the data engine, those would get a separate that would have a different HDF RF, but would basically use the same mechanism.
Yeah, I think if we can have as many things use the same mechanism as possible, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think the magnetometer could also connect directly to the Odroid, and you're going to be taking one measurement per second, I think. The time clock on the Odroid, I'm sure, is quite adequate for that. You don't have to have sub-microsecond timing for that.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that may think that because we have the higher cost version of the personal space weather station, the lower cost version of the personal space weather station, it seems to me to make more sense just to have the magnetometer always connect to the single board computer and not worry about engineering it to go through the data engine.
Well, that's what I would think.
There may be a point when you have a data engine and you don't have a single board computer resident in the chassis. And as a hardware guy, to me, it makes no difference, because I'm going to have four I2C ports on the data engine anyway, because they're going to be used to connect to some sensor that we don't even have an idea of what we're going to connect to today. So, but they're standard interfaces, so they're going to be there anyway, and they kind of come for free. So it's just a matter of how we physically configure the system to figure out where the cables go, where the board plugs into.
Yeah, the PMOD connector is basically, correct me if I'm wrong here, Scott, just a row of square pins on one center that could plug into a PMOD connector from a data engine just as easily as plug over to the Odroid directly, and I don't think the magnetometer extender really care.
Yeah, so that's the advantage of using standard interfaces. They can talk to either one.
Yeah, so we wouldn't really need a separate connector. You would just have a PMOD to Data Engine cable, or you'd have a PMOD to Odroid cable, and there wouldn't be really too much difference between the cable.
So, Scotty, are you saying there's a scenario where we might have one of these things working that wouldn't use a single board computer at all? It would all be just using the Data Engine?
Yeah, I can see that. So envision the idea that you need a lot more horsepower than a Data Engine can provide. An Odroid can provide. You might put this in a box outside next to the antenna and run the Cat 5 inside to your i7 desktop, and it would act as the local processor, and there wouldn't even be a single board computer. In that case, you're really going to have trouble if you want to hook a magnetometer up unless you provide a way for it to connect to a PC.
Okay, I see that. Bill, what do you think about this?
That is a potential use case, yeah. Some people may, well, frankly, I don't know if we'll get the number of channels and the number of antennas and the sample rates out of even an Odroid N2. So if you want the full blown up system that does everything that we've originally imagined, you might have to have it connected to a high end desktop. I don't know that an N2 is necessarily going to be able to live up to some of our dreams that we have had for it after doing some testing. I'm going to continue to see how far I can push it to get the full, basically 16 channels at 192,000 samples per second. Started to look like maybe a stretch for an N.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, and of course, the N2 class computers, the single board computers, are going to get more and more powerful as time goes on. So there may be a point when it is powerful enough, but right today, I think we should make sure we at least have an option to do it the other way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
And of course, once the N2 comes out to be an N3 or an N4 or an N5 that has the power of an i7, then your Xeon class quintuple core processor that you can have on your desktop, the 1 kilowatt model, will then of course be even more powerful.
Well, I mean, they are even talking about single board comes with graphics processing units on it, so you can do parallel processing and everything. I mean, all that stuff is starting to come out, so I'm sure that will become available.
Yeah, and you know, Bill, have you thought about the possibility of maybe using like a Jetson board and using the graphics engine to do the encoding?
Well, I haven't thought about that. It certainly could bear some investigation.
Because Phil Harmon claims he can do a more than 20 megahertz wide FFT in real time on a board with 192 CUDA cores.
Well, I don't doubt it. I mean, but yeah, I mean, it kind of depends on which GPU you're talking about. I mean, they make some that it dims the lights when you turn them on. So, but I don't know. I'd have to. I guess if you have any links to articles on that, why don't you send them along and I'll bring myself up to speed on them.
Okay, I just was throwing that out as a hand grenade in the kitchen because I know very little about what the capabilities of the GPUs are and whether that would be a good use case. I mean, an FFT obviously has lots of high-powered math in it. The encoding, maybe not so much.
Well, doing the FFT is something that a graphics processing unit is usually pretty well suited for. And I'm not an expert on GPUs, but I know that a lot of the stuff that I'm doing that involves for TensorFlow that I'm using for the artificial intelligence neural network then for analyzing propagation for sporadic E and all that stuff, all of that is done in floating point. The way you speed it up is put on a GPU, and it makes a difference of at least 100x. So I would think that probably a graphics processing board would be just what the doctor ordered with regard to if you want to pre-process the data. I mean, we've been talking about saving raw data. If we want to have something that's going to pre-process it, the graphics processing unit would certainly be a very powerful feature for that.
Well, I'm not sure what's involved in the encoding, the HDF5 encoding. That's what you're trying to do on the Odroid, right?
Oh, the encode. Well, the encode. That's lightweight computation. That there's very little processing that they do. That stuff is they don't do a whole lot to. It's stored very much like you stuff it in there. If you take a look at the speeds, the speed you can get while just writing raw data to disk is just a little faster speed you get by saving it in HDF5 when you're using digital RF module. So it's not, no, it's the analysis that's the heavy duty computational task.
Okay, and that's the one that might lend itself to GPU application, but that sounds like a down the road kind of problem.
Yeah, I mean, by the time we get to that, what we might be doing is, you know, you can set up with Amazon Web Services and other outfits like that, you can buy GPU time. And when it comes time for us to get a lot of results from a lot of different space weather stations and do a lot of analysis, you know, looking at the Doppler shifts and all of that across a wide range of different data, we may want to use something like that to speed up the processing. You can get orders of magnitude, but this is probably not really germane to our hardware discussion. So,
okay, worth a shot anyway. Well, here we are at 1 hour. It's been a great discussion. I'm going to have to take off here pretty quick. So anything else that anyone wants to bring up?
A real quick question, Scotty. Odroid, does that handle I/O?
Ooh, that's a good question. I know the Pis mostly are going down to 1.8. Let's see, I guess Dave is not here. Do you know that answer to that, Bill?
No, I'll have to look into that. The Odroid N2 runs on 12 volts, actually.
Right. But I'm just curious whether that processor has any 3.3 volt I/O, because they'll have separate I/O banks, and some of them will be adjustable, so you can select, you know, 1.8, 2.5, 3.3. But some of the Raspberry Pi outputs are restricted to 1.8 volts only. I'm not sure if all of them are on the 3 or not. So, yeah, that's a good question. We can find that answer out, Tom.
Okay. I was looking, you know, for I squared C, and then if the Odroid is capable of supplying a few hundred milliamps at volts.
Yeah, and I wouldn't rely on the Odroid to supply any power, any extra power. So I think that's going to be up to the data engine. Although, I guess you're right, though. If you plug that into the directly into the Odroid, it's going to have to supply the power, isn't it?
Yeah. It's not going to be much, but I figured we're going to need 3.3 volt I/O and 5 volt power if we're going to plug the magnetometer directly into the Odroid. Anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
It's food for thought. I'm sure somebody got a spec somewhere.
I was looking it up here, but I don't think I can get to them that fast.
Okay. Well, we'll let you go. It's been an hour and things are moving.
Yeah. Thanks everyone for coming in and sharing the excitement of the DASI grant.
Thanks a lot, everyone. I really appreciate it. And thanks for all of your good work.
I do see on the GPIO 3.3 volt power, 5 volt power. But the question you're really asking is, what is the voltage requirements of the GPIO? Is that the question?
Yeah. The I squared C driver IC part, as is Tomator IC. The local extender has to, if it's plugged directly, has to have three.
Yeah, I think we're good on that. The words off their website is the N2 GPIO interface is similar to C2 and fully supports a 3.3 volt interface, while the N1 could only support 2.8 volt I/O. So this is beneficial for using various peripherals without level shifters. So it looks very promising on that from what I've been able to find.
Yeah, that's okay. Exactly what we need. Right, Tom?
Yep. It seems like a lot of folks have stand for you so far.
And then the only other issue is, does the Odroid power supply, since it runs off of 12 volt, does it have enough extra overhead on the 5 volt to run our adapter and remote sensor?
Exactly. It's not much, but it's more.
I think probably because they say that the N2 power requirements are not that huge. And typically the power supplies I've been seeing people supplying with the N2 are fairly substantial. So there should be a little bit of overhead room for that.
So, hey, Tom, a quick question. Do you envision an application where there will be an Odroid and no data engine?
Well, that was what Nathaniel was discussing. We might want to plug their directly in. So for the low cost thing, that's not exactly the project. There was a very, very low cost version he was thinking. Did I understand that correctly, Nathaniel?
Yeah, that's correct.
So the low cost version would be an Odroid and a magnetometer and no RF then?
No, that's not true. There would be RF. But the RF would be basically a purpose-built receiver that would only be looking at Doppler shifts from, say, WWV and CHU. And Case Western are the people that will be working on that form of the RF.
Yeah, this is Dave's receiver array, right?
That's correct.
Okay, I was just wondering if that, you know, might be able to steal 50 milliamps at 5 volts from that. And, you know, we could power the thing from the another board if it's there.
That's possible. We may have to, maybe it's a good idea to bring Dave into discussion as well at some point.
Well, Tom, do you think you're going to have a good handle on how much power we're going to need?
Yeah. I just need to look it up on the specs. I've got the specs. And
okay, very good. So we'll get that in the ICD, and then we can see where we can get it from. But sounds like it's probably going to be low enough that we can steal it from either place.
Yeah, I've also got to put in the line termination resistors because we have to terminate all the lines at 100 ohms. It'll take some DC power.